Ecclesiastes chapter 8, and we're looking at verses 1 through 9. This was a tough passage to put together. As we go on in Ecclesiastes, Solomon is going to break up some of his thoughts. They don't always flow well, so you'll have to bear with me. I thought about that. Sometimes we as people, we do the same thing, right? I mean, just this morning, I couldn't remember what I was going to say, and right in the middle of prayer, I had that thought came back to me. And Solomon was a man, although this book was divinely inspired by God, we still see some of the elements of the human writer here. And so I think that's where we're going to see Solomon in this chapter of Ecclesiastes, where some things don't seem to fit, but they are the thoughts of a man as it progresses through these verses. So Ecclesiastes 8, verses 1 through 9. Before we get there, I want to tell you a story about a guy named Helmuth James Graf von Moltke. Helmuth James Graf von Moltke. Okay, he's a German guy born in 1907 in what was known as Perugia, Germany at the time. That's now the country of Poland. And Moltke's parents were both Christian scientists. They raised him in a tradition of the Evangelical Church of Perugia at that time. And Moltke was confirmed as a Christian at the age of 14. An interesting side note, at this time, the Perugian churches were part of a larger Protestant group of churches. Both Lutheran and Reformed churches had come together to form a coalition during the mid to late 1800s and the early 1900s. And Moltke was part of a church of these groups. Other known people that you probably have heard of before were Karl Barth, the Swiss reformer, Martin Niemöller, the German Lutheran pastor, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. They were all part of these groups of churches that Moltke was part of. And all those pastors that I just listed, including Moltke himself, were part of the Nazi resistance. They were part of the opposition against Nazi Germany. Moltke grew up to study law. He married his wife, Freya Dyckman. She was also studying to become a lawyer. They were both very educated people. They were wed in 1931, and they later moved to Berlin, Germany to finish their legal studies and training. In 1935, Moltke was actually invited to become a judge in Berlin, but he declined the opportunity because if you became a judge at that time, you had to join the Nazi Party, and he didn't want to do that. Instead, he opened up his own law practice, and he used his expertise in international law to help victims actually immigrate out of Germany. He was doing it legally, getting their papers together, probably similar to what you're trying to do to stay in this country. He was doing to get people out of the country and to get them landed in other countries. When World War II broke out, it broke out with the German invasion of Poland. So it was Moltke's kind of homeland where that started. And at the start of the war, he was immediately drafted and forced to work in counterintelligence for the Nazi Party. So the party that he was trying to avoid this whole time, he was now forced to work for and work under. During his tenure working for the Nazi Party in counterintelligence, Moltke would have to travel through German-occupied territories. And along the routes, he would witness firsthand many human rights violations and abuses that the Nazi regime inflicted on those people in those opposing countries and their own country. And most notoriously, he saw the affliction of the Jewish people. Moltke attempted to thwart the human rights violations by writing legal principles and urging the German government to obey the Geneva Convention and international laws regarding human rights treatment of hostages and prisoners of war. And for the most part, his legal recommendations were largely ignored. And as he continued to work under this oppressive regime, he spent the remainder of his military career surreptitiously spreading secret information about the Nazi Party, about the Nazi concentration camps, and information from the German war front to other countries, including the United States and Great Britain. Moltke attempted twice to contact British officials to let them know that he would personally go to any length possible to assist them in their war effort. But the British officials ignored him. They never responded to him. He was also part of a secret group of anti-Hitler Germans, a coalition, including people in the German military who wanted to end the war from within Germany. They were actually willing to work with the Allies and work with the British forces to stop the tyranny of Adolf Hitler. Moltke's group passed a report on to President Roosevelt about their plan to work alongside of them. But Roosevelt's advisor counseled against the credibility of the report, and they advised Roosevelt not to work with Moltke. They didn't trust the sources that it was coming from. Through all this, Moltke believed that it would be wrong for him to use violence against his own government. But because of his Christian faith, he continued to do whatever he could to rescue as many prisoners as he could from certain death by moving them to safer locations. In a 1942 letter smuggled to a British friend, Moltke wrote this. And this is after he's been in this counterintelligence group for several years, and he just continues to see the deterioration of his country. He says this: "Today, not a numerous but an active part of the German people are beginning to realize not that they have been led astray, not that bad times await them, not that the war may end in defeat, but that what is happening is sin. And they are personally responsible." Speaking of the German people, he says, "They are personally responsible for each terrible deed that has been committed, naturally, not in the earthly sense, but as Christians." Moltke felt the pressure of what the German people were doing to their own people, to the Jewish people, to other people. He recognized it as sin, and people in Germany were feeling that for the first time. Eventually, his efforts as a anti-Nazi, anti-Hitler oppositionist, they were discovered. In 1944, he was arrested by the Gestapo. He was accused of treason, put on trial. They chalked up some false charges against him, and he was sentenced to death. In a letter to his beloved wife Freya, he described a moment in his trial where the judge went off on a tirade against him and against his faith in Christ. The judge demanded that Moltke declare who his ultimate authority or loyalty was to. And he said this, the judge said this, "From the other world or from Adolf Hitler?" Asking where his loyalty lie. "Where lie your loyalty and your faith?" Moltke said that he stood before the court, and not as a Protestant, not as a great landowner, not as an aristocrat, not as a Peruvian, not even as a German, but as a Christian and nothing else. He went on to write this: "But what the Third Reich is so terrified of is ultimately the following: a private individual, your husband, of whom it is established that he discussed with two clergymen of both denominations," talking about Protestant and Catholics, "questions of the practical, ethical demands of Christianity." He was really pushing back against his people about the morality through the entire war. He said, "Nothing else, for that alone we are condemned." He said, "I wept a little, not because I was sad or melancholy, but because I was thankful and moved by this proof of God's presence." Moltke was sentenced to death in January 11th, 1945. He was hanged 12 days later in a prison in Berlin. He left behind his wife and their two sons. And interestingly, the war ended 8 months later after his death. His faith in Christ enabled him to act wisely in his service to his government, even a government that he was opposed against and was secretly working to overthrow. Although he was under someone else's control and forced into a position that he never wanted, he still knew where his real loyalty lay. He put all his hope and trust in Jesus Christ, and in return, he was given the wisdom that strengthened and guided him during the darkest hours of his life. This morning, Solomon is going to tell us how to exercise that same type of wisdom in our lives. That same type of wisdom when we have to submit to earthly authorities. Practical guidance for dealing with earthly government or other forms of authority, you know, your bosses or even your parents to that degree. Whether that authority is good or evil, how do we work in those environments? The opening verse of chapter 8 is a summary of what chapter 7 said about wisdom. That wisdom in the end is far better than foolishness. And although sometimes it appears to be hard to find, the wisdom of God is to be sought after and chosen more than anything else in our lives. God's wisdom is what brings us true life, true living. Not just in this life, but in the one to come. And the first thing that Solomon tells us in verse 1 is what wisdom looks like. And this is where it gets a little different. We're talking about, to some degree, our submission under authorities. But then Solomon starts out by telling us what wisdom looks like. Look at verse 1 with me. He says, "Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed." Now, I spent a little time on this verse because I found it to be very, very interesting. The first thing first, Solomon is asking a rhetorical question. He says, "Who is like the wise? Who are like the wise people? And who knows the interpretation of a thing?" And the answer to that question ultimately is no one is like the wise. No one's like the wise. No one knows how to interpret wise things except other wise people. Okay? So the wisdom that Solomon's talking about is not man's wisdom here, not man's intellect, not the scholarly aspect of men, not the wisdom of like a college professor. It's not what he's speaking of. Solomon's speaking of a wisdom that can only be possessed by those who have been regenerated by the Holy Spirit. He's talking about redeemed people who not only understand but wholeheartedly believe that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. So essentially, Solomon's talking about Christians. Not that the Christians are more intelligent, but that because they have put their faith and trust in the Lord, Solomon says that no one else is like these people. No one else knows how to navigate life like the Christian does. And he says something very interesting. He says that those who possess this life-giving wisdom, the salvation of Christ in their lives, he says that even their countenance, their physical appearance is different. And I find that to be absolutely fascinating. I don't know if you've ever noticed this in other people or not, but have you ever looked at people, and we were talking about this a week or so ago with the Lambs, have you ever looked at someone and you just kind of recognize, like, man, are they a Christian? Just because of how they looked? Have you ever seen that in other people? I've seen that before, and I've always thought that in the back of my mind, like, there's something to the way a Christian looks that you can almost tell that they're a Christian. And so Solomon says the same thing here. He says that the second half of verse 1, he says, "A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed." And so something in the facial expressions, something in the eyes, something in the general appearance of a Christian gives them a different countenance than other people in the world. Now, I have to admit, this is not a telltale sign of whether someone's saved or not. You can't look and, oh, that's a good-looking person. They must be a Christian, right? That's not how this works. I don't think he's talking about physical beauty here. He's talking about something deeper than that, something deeper than just the, I mean, you see it on their outward expression, but it's something much deeper within them that is being revealed through them that you can tell. And I will give you a warning. Do not use my face as the guide here, okay? Please don't do that. I got to tell you this story. It's pretty funny. Our hot water went out a couple weeks ago, and we had the plumbers come in. And I called them. I said, hey, we need a new hot water tank. We had a 40-gallon tank. And for a family of seven, 40 gallons of hot water does not go very far. We were usually out of hot water by noon. And so I always told Andrew, when we do this, when this thing finally goes down, we're going to upgrade. And we did. We got a tankless water system, right? And you can have hot water all day long. It never runs out. They're great. So I called the plumbers. I said, hey, here's what we want to do. Come in and do this. And I let them in the morning. I showed them where I wanted everything set up, right? I said, I want this put here. And then you got to run different exhaust vents. And I said, put these exhaust vents here. And we spent some time with each other. And so these guys were working. And the tankless system took 6 to 8 hours. I think they were there putting this thing in. It's a long process. And so I spent a little bit of time with them, but I couldn't stay there all day. I had to leave. So I left later in the afternoon, and Andrew and Sayla were home. We were out helping somebody move, me and the older kids. And they finally finished up, and they came upstairs, and they were telling Andrew how this system works. And they gave her a booklet. And they said, explaining things to her. And she said, well, my father was really interested in how these things work. And one of the guys said, well, is your father going to be back home anytime soon? And she said, what are you talking about back home? And they said, yeah, is your father going to be back home? We can show him how this works. Well, they were talking about me. They thought I was Andrew's father, And they must have thought I was Selah's grandfather. You know, so I was like, you got to be kidding me. And so, the guy had a puzzled look on her face. He's like, Andrew explained to him, well, no, that was my husband you saw earlier. And he's like, oh, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to say that. Didn't mean to do that. And she told me the story, and she actually had a very pleasant day because someone thought I was her grandfather, and she looked very young, and she was very happy. But, man, I was kind of put down. And so the guy apologized. He said, oh, ma'am, it's been a long day. And I told Andrew, like, long day in my eye. You know, I just look, I look old. I mean, something, you know. So obviously Andrew's much more youthful and radiant looking than I am. I'm 2 years younger than she is, and they still thought I was her father. The kids got a real – what's that? Yeah, we had cold showers for a week, so maybe that's what it was. It was weighing on my face. The kids got a kick out of it. I think one of them asked Andrew if they could help put Grandpa to bed later that night. So, but a person's countenance, regardless of my face, causes a wise person's face to shine. Godly countenance causes a wise person's face to shine. And what I found cool about this was there was some biblical evidence that backs up this claim. If you remember Daniel, where Daniel was taken by the Babylonians, he was taken captive and put under King Nebuchadnezzar's court. And it says in Daniel chapter 1 that Daniel had to use wisdom to discern how he was going to live under these circumstances of being a captive in a foreign land. Daniel and his friends they wisely refused to defile themselves with the king's food because that food had been offered in sacrifice to idols. So they said, we're not going to eat that food. It could have meant death for them. But they did it anyways. They did it in a respectful way. And at the end of this testing period that King Nebuchadnezzar put on, he discovered that Daniel and his friends were actually 10 times wiser than the wisest people in his entire kingdom. These guys were smarter, okay, than all these other people that went through this phase. But not only that, Daniel and his other friends looked better physically than all the other people that had gone through this. It says in Daniel 1:15, at the end of 10 days, it was seen with their eyes, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate at the king's food, at the king's table. So they looked better. There was something about them. Godly wisdom makes a difference in the way we look. People who live without God in this world will over time begin to show the cold, spiritless expression of a life hardened by sin. You can actually see it in their face. This is what Solomon calls the hardness of the face. And so the contrast that Solomon has here is the face of a hardened sinner to that of one whose face has been changed by wisdom. Changed by wisdom. Psalm 34, 4 and 5 says, I sought the Lord and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. And then it says this, those who look to him are radiant. Those who look to the Lord are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. So there's evidence that there's something there in the life of a Christian that gives off this countenance of peace and the way they look. Proverbs 15, 13 says, a glad heart makes a cheerful face. A glad heart makes a cheerful face, but by sorrow of heart, the spirit is crushed. And the reprobate, you can see that on their face sometimes. Their spirits are crushed because they don't have the living spirit of Christ living in them. Matthew Paris was a journalist for the Times. It's a British newspaper agency out of London. And Paris makes it clear that he's not a Christian. I think he's an atheist. And he does not believe in God. But he wrote an article titled, Why Africa Needs God. Kind of weird what an atheist would write an article why a country would need God. And in the article, he admitted there was a tangible difference that Christianity made in the lives of people that he observed in several of the countries that he traveled through in Africa. He not only admired the good work that the Christians were doing and caring for the poor and the sick, but he also noted that he noticed a difference in the way they looked. Okay, in the article, it says this. He says, the Christians were different. Their faith appeared to have liberated and relaxed them. There was a liveliness, a curiosity, an engagement with the world. Whenever we entered a territory worked by missionaries, we had to acknowledge that something changed in the faces of the people we passed and spoke to, something in their eyes. There's no denying, even to a sinful world, that biblical wisdom brings about a personal transformation in the countenance of the Christian. The life-changing joy that wisdom brings makes their faces shine so much that the world has to take notice. They can't ignore that. Solomon says this is how wisdom looks. Okay, again, it's not a telltale sign. It doesn't mean you can pick and choose who's a Christian, who's not a Christian, just on the way they look. But there is something to it. There is something to that, to their countenance for someone who is saved. Next, Solomon is going to tell us what wisdom does. So that's what wisdom looks like. Here is what wisdom does. Read verses 2 to 4 with me. He says, I say, keep the king's command because of God's oath to him. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, what are you doing? So submission to authority is probably one of the most hot topic issues for American Christianity today, something that we have to deal with. It's a real struggle, usually because the authorities over us or the people who reign over us are not always godly people. I would say more often than not, they're not godly people, right? And every day, if you pay attention, we hear news stories of how Christian liberties are being stripped away in our country. It just happens every single day. There's new stories of different things, of liberties being taken away. And at some point in time, we've got to settle this in our minds. When it comes to our authorities, whoever they may be, it could be our president, our governor, our bosses, whoever holds authority over us. At some point in time, we're going to be faced into a position where we're going to be asked to compromise on our faith. Expect that to happen, okay? Anticipate that to happen. We're going to be asked to be put into a position that compromises our faith. On a national scale here in the U.S., we felt this pressure of overbearing government for quite some time now. Just in our recent history, right, in the last 15 or 16 months, we're coming out of this nationwide shutdown, right, for COVID. And myriads of people have lost their businesses. They've lost their livelihoods. They can't provide for their families because the government made a decision to shut, essentially, the country down. I know some states have fought against that, and they've remained open, and they've done well. But many states haven't. I was looking at thankfully, we're coming out of that, right? I think it was Wednesday. A lot of our restrictions were lifted. And I watch the stock market. I pay attention to the stock market as much as I can. But just on the anticipation that things were going to stop with the restrictions, the stock market went high, very high on Wednesday. And I was watching AMC Theaters. Their stock jumped over 120% in the past week, just in the anticipation that people were going to go back to the movie theaters. And then Wednesday, when the restrictions actually lifted, it jumped another 100% that day. Now, there were some pushers and movers behind this stock that pushed it all the way up. So don't go get into it now because it's all the way back down. But if you would have held stock just on Wednesday, you would have had a 100% return on your investment. But people are excited that these things are going to open up. And I am too. I'm ready for the restrictions to be loosened up and get back to normal. I'm ready to go back to the restaurant. I'm ready not to go back, not to have to social distance and not have to wear my mask to go sit down at the table and then all of a sudden be safe from COVID and take my mask off, you know, things like that. But I observed something in the church during the lockdown in the past 15 months, okay? I think in many ways, we as a Western Christianity, evangelical church, we were faced with so many uncertainties and so mixed data that we weren't sure who to listen to. And it caused a lot of chaos in the church. It really did. It wasn't just other churches that struggled. You know, we read stories about all these other churches that struggled on how to navigate these waters we found ourselves in. But quite honest, our church struggled too. This was a first for us. This is the first time we had to struggle with some of these things as a body. I remember when COVID first started, we met, the leadership team met at a restaurant, and we're trying to, you know, come up with a plan. How are we going to move forward through all these mandates and restrictions that the government's putting on us? What are we going to do here? And we were searching for other churches, like, what is this church doing? Do we like this guy? Do we not like this guy? You know, what are they doing? And so with the limited information we had, we decided to hold off on physically meeting for a few weeks. I think we closed our doors for maybe 4 weeks. We developed an online service, live stream service, and And that went okay. I mean, it wasn't the same as physically meeting. And we did all the prayer service on Wednesdays as well to try to meet, you know, a little bit more, even though virtually we wanted to see each other's faces a little bit more, so we did that. And so we did that for 4 weeks. And then we decided to open our church back up physically. But even then, when we opened the church up, we had additional hurdles to go through. Are we going to require 6-foot physical barriers between people? Are we going to mandate mask policies? Are we going to, you know, how are we going to do all these? Are we going to have our potluck meals? Are we going to go without them for a while? Who's going to enforce all this stuff? You know, are we putting people at the doors, enforcers? You know, if you have a mask, you can enter. If you don't have a mask, you can't. We had to come with all these things. And it was a trying time for our body. And it certainly didn't come without controversy. And I don't think Eric and Owen and I were always on the same page, to be honest with you. We had our own little internal battles and butting of the heads of what we were going to do, you know. We worked through them as brothers in love and admonition for each other, and we worked through those things. And we compromised through some of this stuff. But it was a very difficult time in our church's history to navigate through. I personally was very strong in support of the mask mandate. I didn't agree with it all. I didn't see it as an area where the government was making me sin. So I, you know, tried to, you know, fall under that submission to that authority. And that may have been the cause for some people to be upset or have angst with us, you know. And I take full responsibility for that, you know. But with the information we had, those are the decisions we made. But over time, you know, the rules kept changing on the mask. And now we're coming out where Fauci's emails are saying, well, the masks weren't even effective at all. You know, that's what his truth he admitted to months and months ago. So we loosened up on wearing them at the church. And I think finally a few months ago, my family rebelled against me. I don't know if you ever saw it. I tried to wear the mask. My whole family came in without wearing a mask. So it really was pointless, you know. But I tried to take the higher road, and I don't think I did. I think I took the road less traveled. I don't know. But they rebelled against me, and that was okay. I wasn't mad at them. I left it up to their own conscience to do that. And I think for the most part, we let everybody in the church handle that with what they saw fit, right? And it was an opportunity for us as a church to show brotherly love and kindness and grace to each other. We all had different opinions, didn't we? And some people would, you know, wear a mask all the time. Some people didn't want to wear a mask at all. And we showed love for each other, I think, you know, by having those differences, working through those differences, and loving each other regardless. I still love my family, even though they rebelled, you know. They love me, even though I was probably a weirdo. But we allowed for that. We allowed for the conscience to guide people how they felt was right, or the right thing to do regarding these mask policies. But this restriction over COVID, it really caused those in the church to ask some very significant questions, probably for the first time in their lives. Probably questions they've always thought in the back of their minds, but now you're faced with it. Now you have to make a decision. Does obedience to the authorities have limits? When God tells us to obey those who are in authority over us, is there a limit to that obedience? Must I always submit to the governing authorities, or are there times when my duty as a Christian is to disobey? And I think we saw for the real time, in at least in our history, we were forced as a church to make decisions based upon our own government's decree that directly affected how we worship. And we got off pretty easy. You know, say what you will about Mike DeWine. You know, and we're probably not, I don't know if you're a fan of him or not. But he did appear to steer clear of gathering for worship, right? He didn't shut churches down. He had stipulations and restrictions, but he didn't actually close our doors. As you know, John MacArthur's church, they found themselves right in the middle of a huge legal battle with their governor. And I don't know if that's still going on. It might still be. I haven't followed it. I don't know if I think it was going to the Supreme Court in California, but they're still gathering. They did shut down for a few weeks, and then they opened back up. But MacArthur potentially risked being arrested for doing the exact same thing that we had been doing for months, just gathering to worship God. And it was kind of interesting. I listened to an interview that a news agency did with MacArthur, and he was actually kind of excited about the pressure from the government. He said, I've never had a jailhouse ministry before. I've always wanted to do that. And so he was kind of excited about getting arrested and starting this jailhouse ministry. And I chuckled at that. But when you think about it, the reality is he wasn't that far from it. And he's an American pastor. And he wasn't that far from getting arrested and being put in jail for worshiping God. We're not that far from it. You're probably all aware of the pastor in Canada, James Coates. He was a Grace to You or Grace Theological Seminary guy. He was arrested in Canada. He was put in prison for gathering to worship God on Sunday. And I don't know if I'm entirely accurate on this statement, but I think the arrest of that pastor may be one of the most significant acts of tyranny against the Western church today. And it's right in our backyard. Those are our neighbors to our north. But it's probably one of the most significant acts of tyranny of Western Christianity that we've ever seen in our lifetime. The Canadian government, I think it was his church, they actually erected, I know it was a church in Canada, I'm pretty sure it was his, but they erected a barbed wire fence around the church to keep people from gathering together to worship, to keep them out, to stop the spread of a virus. Coates himself was placed in solitary confinement. I saw an interview with his wife. They interviewed his wife on Fox News. She said her husband was placed in solitary confinement for 2 weeks. Now, this isn't a murderer. This isn't the guy who went out and murdered a bunch of people. He was going to preach the word of God. They put him in solitary confinement for 2 weeks. And within those 2 weeks, he was allowed to have 2 15-minute breaks to go outside, to do other things where he wasn't by himself. And they said, well, he had to quarantine. That's why we put him in solitary confinement, because he had to quarantine for 2 weeks. That's tyranny. That is government oppression on Christians. We're seeing it in our lifetime for the first time in our Western civilization. And for the first time, the Western church is being faced with decisions that we have never had to make before. And we have the threat of being arrested, or do we obey God? And that reality is becoming more and more closer to home than I think we want to think about. The path forward, moving forward in our American Christianity or American church, is going to require some supernatural wisdom. It's going to require wisdom to navigate this murky road that lies ahead. And so what is the wise and godly way for us to live under someone else's authority? We have to ask those questions now before we're faced with that question later. What's the wise and godly way to live under someone else's authority? The first thing that King Solomon says is that wisdom will teach us to keep the king's command. That's the first step. The first step is to keep the king's command, to obey the king. Wisdom tells us that we should first strive to obey the king in every situation that we morally and biblically can. That's the caveat. You obey the king biblically. Okay? In the original context of what Solomon wrote in these verses, they applied the verses applied to the lives of people who served in the royal court, much like Daniel did under King Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. Daniel didn't choose to serve King Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel was forced in that position to serve King Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar wasn't necessarily a good man to serve. Daniel, although he was under those conditions, he understood his role under the authority of King Nebuchadnezzar. And wherever and whenever Daniel could, he honored the king. Now, that command to honor the king and those authority goes way beyond the royal courts of monarchs and kings, okay? In general, the general principle is that we're to submit to those whom God has put in authority over our lives, over our personal lives, whatever that authority may be. This includes every citizen, every employee, every child to their parents, every person who's called to submit to any authority that God has placed over them. Okay? Paul wrote in Romans 13 that every person should be subject to the governing authorities. And the biggest reason that we're to be subject to these authorities and first obey the king whenever possible is because of what else Paul says in Romans 13. He says, there is no authority except from God. No authority except from God. And those that do exist have been instituted by God. He put them there. He says, therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. So the first thing we have to realize when we obey the king is that our obedience to these authorities, and again, that king term is used loosely. It could be your employer, it could be whoever holds authority over you. But when we obey the king and we obey the authorities in our life, what Solomon is saying is that we are bringing honor to God because God's the one who has put those people into position because of his oath to those leaders. Paul says that the one who is in authority is a servant of God. That authority figure is a servant of God. Whether they be good or evil, they are still a servant of God, and they are in place for our own good. So we are to be in subjection to these authorities out of a sense of obligation to the God that we serve. And then we're to keep our own conscience clear by serving them well. And this isn't a sermon on Romans 13. That would probably take several weeks to unpack. But the gist of it is this. We obey the rulers and authorities in our own lives because it's an act of obedience to our God, and because he's the one who ordained those authorities. Now, that's easy to say, right? We can say that. We could probably all agree with that. But then we still have the burning question. When is it okay to disobey those authorities? When is it okay to defy the government? When is it okay to disobey those who rule over us? Well, every situation in any scenario that you could conjecture in your mind is going to be different, right? There's a myriad of contingencies we could place and come up with in our minds, and they're all going to be different. But the general principle, the general rule, if you will, as a wise Christian, is that we should follow, what we should follow when faced with a moral dilemma is this. The simple answer is what Peter gave when he was told to stop preaching the gospel. And this is in the book of Acts. Peter was preaching. He was told to stop preaching, spreading God's word. He was under the threat of arrest and imprisonment. And Peter simply answered, "We must obey God rather than men. We must obey God rather than men." When it comes to a conflict between God and man, our duty as Christians is to obey the higher authority. Okay, when it comes between a conflict between God and men, our duty as Christians is to obey the higher authority. The higher authority is always God. If any of man's decrees, whether they be from a king, from a president, from a governor, a boss, or even a parent, if that decree is in direct violation to what God has told us to do in his word, we obey God. And that's the easy answer, okay? That's the general rule, right? We obey the higher authority. Now, it's going to take wisdom to understand when that time comes. Solomon says not to be hasty when leaving the king's presence, okay? In Solomon's day, if you were to stand before a king and that king issued a decree or an order that maybe our judgment you didn't agree with, and you were to exit his presence in a hasty or a disrespectful manner, that was a sign of a huge sign of disrespect to the king. You could actually be killed for that. The king could actually take your life for disrespecting the way you exit his presence. Okay? A hasty departure was kind of a way to turn your back, so to speak, on the king's authority. And for some people, like I said, that literally meant death. Solomon's not saying that we never have an obligation to disobey. There are times to disobey our government or our rulers. And those times exist when we have a higher obligation to obey God. But he is telling us that we need to use wisdom. If we're going to walk away from the king, and we're going to walk away from the king's decrees, we've got to apply wisdom when doing so. We have to apply wisdom when doing so. Solomon warns us not to take our stand in an evil cause. And what he's basically saying here is that we need to be discerning, even though we may be under the oppression of a tyrannical ruler. Okay. Now, it's tempting to think that because our current ruler or authority is ungodly or unrighteous, then we're totally justified to rebel them in any way, even if it's an unrighteous way. And that's not what Solomon is saying at all. That's not what the Bible teaches us at all. God would not want us to do that. Paul tells us in Romans 12, verses 17 to 21, he says this, "Repay no one evil for evil. But give thought," he means think, use wisdom, "to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. Do not overcome evil, but overcome, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now that's not to say that there's never a time to fight against tyranny. Certainly we've seen that in times throughout history where it was appropriate to take a stand against ungodliness, against immorality. But Solomon's warning us not to respond to that with more evil. You never combat evil with more evil. We don't do that as Christians. Do not let the desire for revenge to turn your hearts to ungodliness. Now, for Helmut von Moltke in World War II, for him it was a gradual process of disobedience and opposition to his government and the authorities over him. He saw all the atrocities that the German part of the Nazi party was doing. And he worked tirelessly behind the scenes of the Nazi war party for 6 years to adjudicate and save as many lives as he could. Moltke tried to resist Hitler at any chance that he could, but he was under the personal conviction that he was never to turn to violence against his ruler. He just wasn't going to do it. And because he, in his words, he feared that if he were to turn to violence against his ruler, it would make him look no better than a Nazi. Now, we struggle with that, don't we? Because our Americanism is in us says, no, we're fighting, right? We're going to fight. No, nobody's going to come take my guns. Nobody's going to come take my freedoms. Nobody's going to do all this stuff. We wrestle with that stuff. And it's hard. This is a hard, murky area to decipher. One of the letters that Moltke wrote to his two sons while in custody before he was hanged, it revealed his motivation for resistance and the way he resisted his government. He said this, "Since National Socialism came to power, I've striven to make its consequences milder for its victims and to prepare the way for a change. In that, my conscience drove me. And in the end, that is a man's duty." Okay? So his conscience, his conviction was that although his own government would find him to be a traitor, although his own government would condemn him and hang him, he knew he was going to die for the crimes that they put on him. He had an internal conviction to do what was right instead of what was wrong. And he determined to obey God rather than men. And for him, the way that looked, it was to try to free as many people as he could, to try to transfer them to other countries and do things like that. When we feel the urge to fight against the abuse of authority in our lives, we must resent the temptation to repay evil for evil. For whatever reason, Moltke was under the impression that if he were to turn to violence against his government, then it would have been evil for him, okay? And we're going to pick up on that here in a little bit. But the blessing that wisdom is that it's going to help us know the right way to live, including how to submit to a tyrannical government as a loyal citizen of that government. Wisdom is going to help us in those areas. And it's also going to tell us when there is a time to obey God rather than men. Now he reiterates this, Solomon reiterates this in verses 5 to 7. Look at those verses with me real quick and we'll pick back up on that thought. He says, "Whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. For there is a time and a way for everything, although man's troubles lie heavy on him. For he does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be?" I hope I've stirred a little bit of emotion in you this morning. Okay, I've seen some of it on your faces, right? You don't agree with Moltke, do you? And I know that. And then some of you do. Some of you do absolutely agree with this guy. Andrew and I, over the past several days, as I was reading up on him, we had some lively discussions in our home about what we would have done in that situation. And the question came up of the morality for someone to take, like Moltke, to take Hitler's life had he been given the opportunity. I don't know, maybe I have a dark mind. That's where my mind goes. How could I kill this guy, right? If I was in that opportunity, maybe I wouldn't kill him. I don't know. But if given the opportunity, what would I do? Where's the biblical evidence to support or fight against that? The things we have to understand was Hitler was Moltke's God-given authority, whether he liked it or not, right? Hitler was his commander-in-chief. And whether we agree with him or not, Moltke's conviction was that he should not resort to violence, even though he worked within that party. He saw all the atrocities that were going on. But then you take someone like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? Bonhoeffer was not acting within a governmental or a military capacity, but he was convinced that Hitler's life should be taken. And Bonhoeffer actually actively worked in a plot to assassinate Hitler. And so here you have two men. They have similar upbringings. They were both professing Christians. They both attended the similar style churches. They were part of that Perugian network of churches that had similar theology. They were both Germans. They were both aware of the carnage that Hitler was responsible for. And they both came to different conclusions about how they would respond to the evil authority that was over them. So who was right? Which man was right? We'd respect both of these men. We'd honor both. We'd accept both these men in our church, probably. But which one was right? Well, I don't have the answer. I can tell you this. There's prominent Christians on both sides of that argument that make very compelling statements and arguments on which way you should go, on which scenario is the right scenario to go. And I imagine if we took a vote here this morning, that it may be 50-50 even within our own church. How are we going to respond if given the opportunity to take out Hitler, right? One pastor I admire, and I won't share his name, maybe you don't agree with this statement, so I don't want to give him a bad name, but he said he was slow to condemn Bonhoeffer. You got to remember, Bonhoeffer wasn't a military guy. He wasn't a police officer. He wasn't in the Nazi party, okay? He was a citizen of Germany. So what are his rights, biblically speaking, to overthrow the government, right? And so there's a huge argument about that out there in the theological world. But this pastor said he admires Bonhoeffer. He'd be very slow to condemn him, but he says this, in general, I would say we do better as Christians in witnessing to Christ by being willing to suffer and not kill than if we go the other route. Now, in his mind, that's the better way to act as a Christian. He says we do better that way. But then I think, you know, you could make the argument that if Bonhoeffer was successful in the assassination of Hitler, he could have potentially saved hundreds of thousands of innocent lives. So who was more morally right? Moltke or Bonhoeffer? Well, both of them were in unique situations. Both of them had to rest on the wisdom for how they were going to conduct themselves within the authorities that were over them. And what Solomon is telling us here, and I know I'm leaving a big air ball out there. I'm not answering that question for you because I don't have the answer for that question for you. But what Solomon is telling us here is that wise people, the man or the woman who saturate themselves in the wisdom of God, will know the right thing to do and the right time to do it. Both Bonhoeffer and Moltke had their personal convictions. They both had their personal situations that they were involved in. And wisdom guided them, whether that wisdom was successful. They were both tried for treason. They were both killed by their own government. But they both had those convictions based on their individual unique circumstances. And they both had to live with that or die with that, with those decisions. Whether they were right or wrong, whether we agree with them or don't agree with them. But we have to understand that regardless of that, God is sovereign in all of these decisions. He's sovereign in all of our lives. And the wisdom of God will tell us the right thing to do at the right time. Solomon told us early on, there's a time for everything under the sun. There's a time to love and there's a time to hate. There's a time for war and there's a time for peace. There's a time to heal and there's a time to kill. In Solomon's day, there was a time to obey the king and there was a time to leave the king's presence. In our day, there's a time to submit and there's a time to take a stand against evil. And what we struggle with in our day and age today, as Solomon keeps reminding us, is that we struggle sometimes knowing what time it is, right? Our watches aren't working. We don't know what time it is. When do we rise up and rebel? When do we back down and submit? We struggle in those areas of life. The troubles and the frustrations of the things that we see on a daily and weekly basis are troubling to us. Where do we draw the line in the sand? You know, Solomon says no one knows what the future will bring. No one knows whether we're going to go through times of great persecution in the church or times of great prosperity. Will the church in America continue to be stifled, or is religious freedom going to continue to be protected? Life is full of all these uncertainties of things that are out of our control. And Solomon, again, kind of goes to another thought here in the next verses. One of the biggest uncertainties that we have is that we have no control over is the time to die. And that's the certainty of everything, right? There's two things you have to do. They say, pay your taxes and die, right? And we don't know when that time's going to come, but it is going to come. And this is where Solomon moves on. If you look at verses 8 to 9 with me, he says this, no man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There's no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. He says, all this I observe while applying my heart to do all that is done under the sun when man had power over man to his hurt. Solomon has made it repeatedly, abundantly clear that no man has the power to control when they will be born or when they will die. Right? We talked about this a few sermons ago. There's a dash on your headstone that separates your date of birth and that separates the day of your death. You have some control over that dash. But those two dates that follow both sides, you have absolutely no control over. There will come a time in everyone's life where they're going to breathe their last breath. And there will be absolutely nothing that they can do to take even one more. They will not have the power to take even one more breath when it's their time to go. Hebrews 9 tells us that man has an appointment with death. There's an appointment here. And that appointment isn't something that we can change or extend or even cut short for that matter. That appointment is scheduled in God's calendar, and God's timing is perfect. He always keeps his appointments. His timing is perfect. It will not be too soon, and it will not be too late. And as Solomon says here in these verses, no one knows that truth better than a soldier on a battlefield. You've all heard the saying, there's no atheists in foxholes, right? Soldiers in a wartime face moments of uncertain death that most people will never experience in their lifetime. But it's also a moment of very sobering truth. They realize for the moment, oh, I could die here. This could be my last day, right? There's moments that force them to take a sobering look at their own mortality as they come face to face with death. In the heat of the battle, the soldier understands completely that they do not know what the future will bring, or even if they're going to make it out alive. Warfare is a dangerous occupation. But Solomon says here that no amount of wickedness that they see on this battlefield absolves them of their duty to stay in the fight. All right, think about that. You can't become a soldier, go through the training, go through boot camp, learn how to fire your M16, get put out in the middle of the battlefield and be like, yeah, this isn't what I was signed up for. That's not the time to do that, right? It's not the time to do that. A soldier cannot flee his duty to fight for his country. They must do what they're commanded to do. Fleeing from these responsibilities to their governing authority is not an option. In fact, it's criminal to do that. The same real sense as Christians, guys, we have been called into a battle, right? This isn't peacetime for us. You know, we as American Christians, we may have been fattened a little bit. We may be soft and pudgy around the edges, but there's a battle out there. There really is. And we're called into this battle to fight, and this isn't the time to flee from the requirements that have been placed over us. We've all been called to be under someone else's authority. We all face an uncertain future. None of us can predict the day that we're going to die or exit these responsibilities. We have been called to be soldiers in God's army, in the army of Jesus Christ. We've been called to evangelize and share the gospel and worship our God, regardless of what our government authorities do to us. Right? There is a line, and we're called to obey the higher authority. Expect those days to come. Anticipate those days to come. But we can live in the midst of all these uncertainties with the shining face of wisdom. Solomon tells us in Proverbs to get wisdom. Get understanding. At all costs, go and get wisdom. He's talking about the wisdom of God. Submitting ourselves to the sovereignty of God and the lordship of Jesus Christ over our lives is the only way to make our future secure. Despite all the uncertainties that we face in this life, by surrendering our lives to Christ, we're submitting to the wisdom of God. and he will guide us in the right way to live, no matter what circumstance we find ourselves under. In closing, I want to read an excerpt that I read on von Malkin's life during his final hours. I said this, in the last days of his life on earth, Helmuth von Malkin experienced the comfort of knowing Christ. Once he was convicted by the Nazis, von Malkin knew that he was a dead man. Any day could be his last. Nevertheless, in his last letter home, he was filled with joy and confidence in the goodness of God. Von Malkin had the wisdom that comes from knowing Christ. Thus, he was able to tell his beloved wife, Freya, that the agony of parting, the terror of death, and the fear of hell had no power over him. Instead, he was overwhelmed with faith, hope, and charity. He said, I know that I am living only in his grace. We're all only living in God's grace. He also quoted a line from his favorite hymn. He said, "For he for death is ready whose living clings to thee. He for death is ready who living clings to thee." And he said, if we are wise, we too will cling to Jesus Christ, living only in his grace. And in this way, we will be ready for death and everything else that happens in life. You know, I can't tell you where we're going in the future as a country. I think times are becoming more and more real that we're going to suffer persecution. This isn't a surprise, right? Christ told us we're going to suffer. He told us we're going to take up our crosses, you know, an instrument of punishment, an instrument of death, and we're going to follow him. But we can do this with wisdom. And even in the midst of suffering, a myriad of Christians have been whipped and beaten and scourged and burned alive, but their countenance didn't change. The wisdom of Christ was still within them, right? And there's no moments, you know, they look scary from this vantage point. But when you're actually in it, and you're actually going through it, and you feel the presence of God in your life, they mean nothing. They really don't. And we can look forward to if that day comes, and I don't know that it will, maybe it will. But that Christ isn't going to leave us. He's going to be with us in all those times. And for that, we'll give him praise. Let's pray with us this morning. Heavenly Father, I know this was a difficult passage to follow as Solomon.